Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're your shortcut to getting genuinely informed on complex topics.
We dig into the sources so you don't have to.
Exactly. And today, we are tackling something that, well, it affects us all, often in ways we don't even realize. Pesticide safety.
It's surprisingly complex stuff.
It is. Our main source for this is Chapter 8 from Pesticide Safety, Application, Storage, and Cleanup. Specifically, the chapter called Using Pesticides Safely.
A really comprehensive guide.
Right. And our mission today is to pull out the absolute essentials, the core principles of handling pesticides safely, all the way from planting to cleanup.
You know, what's fascinating is how broad it is. It's not just about the moment of application.
Not at all. It's the whole life cycle, really.
It covers everything from, like, the tiny details of mixing to the big picture environmental stuff, a whole system.
Okay, so let's unpack this. The source starts by putting a huge emphasis, actually, right on the applicator. It says, you are the key. How so?
Well, fundamentally, it boils down to diligence and knowledge. Safety really hinges on following that pesticide label to the letter.
Which is basically the law, right?
It is the law for that product, plus all the other regulations, of course. And then there are these really practical steps, like what? Like, if you're mixing different things, test a small amount in a jar first. See if they're compatible. Saves a lot of potential hassle.
Ah, good tip.
And checking your equipment thoroughly. Before every use, look for leaks, faults, anything.
Makes sense.
And one thing the guide really stresses, never, ever use alcohol or drugs before, during, or right after applying pesticides. You need total focus.
So it's really about building these core habits. Read the label, know the rules, work safe, wear your gear.
Your PPE, yeah. Personal protective equipment.
Right, PPE. And protect others. Protect the environment. Avoid hitting non-targets.
Exactly. It sounds like common sense, maybe, but it's easy to miss a step when you're busy.
True. And this leads into planning, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Planning for applications to ensure safety.
Yes. This is critical. It means really studying the safety data sheets, the SDS, and the labels before you start.
Understanding the risks.
And how to avoid them. Inspecting the work area for hazards, too. But here's something that's often overlooked.
What's that?
Planning for accidents. The source really highlights this.
Okay, what does that involve?
It means knowing where the closest medical facility is before you need it. Not scrambling in an emergency.
Right. Proactive.
And knowing who to call for a spill cleanup.
Yeah.
Having those specific emergency numbers, fire, sheriff, highway patrol posted right there at the worksite.
So not just relying on 911.
911 is great, but direct numbers can be faster for specific needs. And always, always have emergency water ready.
For eye washing, skin flushing.
Instantly available. That's key. Preparation is everything.
It really is taking responsibility seriously. Okay, so planning is done. Now, protecting other people. This gets interesting, especially around field workers.
Hugely important. The basic rule is clear. No workers allowed in a treated area or what they call application exclusion zones, AEZs, during application.
And afterwards.
That's where the REI comes, in the restricted entry interval.
Okay. Explain REI.
It's a mandatory waiting period after application before anyone can go back into that treated area. It's set by the label and state regulations, like the California Code of Regulations, Title III.
And what if you mix products with different REIs?
Good question. The rule is simple. You always use the longest REI listed on any of the labels you're using. No exceptions.
Safety first. Got it. And the guide talks about posting requirements, signs, basically.
Yes, clear warnings. Posting is mandatory if the REI is over 48 hours, even if the label doesn't specifically say so.
And these aren't just any signs.
No, they have specific requirements. Durable material, easily readable from 25 feet. They need to be in English and any other language common among the workers there.
Makes sense.
And they must have the skull and crossbone symbol and the word danger.
Very clear visual warning.
Exactly. And if the REI is longer, like over 7 days, the sign needs even more info. The pesticide name, the exact date the REI ends, the property operator's name, field ID.
Wow, quite detailed.
It has to be. There are even extra sign rules for certain high-risk pesticides applied through irrigation systems, chemigation.
And where do these signs go?
At all the usual entry points to the field or area. If it's unfenced, then at the corners and along any public roads, no more than 600 feet apart.
And the timing?
You post them before you apply, but not more than 24 hours before. They stay up for the entire REI.
Amen.
Take them down within 3 days after the REI ends. You don't want old warnings confusing people.
Right. So signs are one part. What about notification?
That's about directly informing employees. Anyone working within a quarter mile of an agricultural treatment needs to be notified.
How?
It can be oral where it can be done with signs. They need to know when the application will happen, what's being used, the potential hazards, and those re-entry times.
So multiple layers of communication. Signs and direct word.
Correct. Ensuring everyone is aware.
Okay, let's shift gears. Getting the pesticide to the site, transporting it safely. It's more than just throwing it in the back, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a really critical step. First off, the vehicle itself needs to be in good shape. Brakes, tires, steering, all sound.
Basic vehicle safety, but extra important here.
Definitely. And here's the big one. Pesticides should never be carried in the passenger compartment, ever.
Why is that? Spill risk. Fumes.
Both. A spill inside the cab is a serious hazard, and even fumes from sealed containers can be risky in an enclosed space.
So if you have something like a van,
make sure it's well ventilated, and ideally have a solid barrier separating the cargo area from the driver and any passengers.
And securing the actual containers?
Paramount. They need to be protected from getting torn or punctured, and they mustn't shift around. Figure 8.2 in the source probably shows good examples.
An enclosed cargo box sounds best.
It offers the best protection and security, definitely. Well, if you're using an open truck bed, you've got to be extra careful they don't get stolen or, you know, fall out on a sharp turn or bump.
And stacking.
Never stack them higher than the sides of the truck bed. And check the bed itself. Make sure there are no nails or sharp objects that could damage the containers.
Good point. Steel bed better than wood.
Much better if a spill happens. Easier to clean, less absorbent.
And the driver's responsibility in all this. Especially if something does go wrong, like a spill on the road.
In California, the vehicle operator is responsible. They need to contact emergency agencies immediately and make sure the spill gets cleaned up properly.
Which raises a key question. What information should that driver have before they even turn the key?
Great question. They need those emergency contacts readily available. They need to know what information to report, what was spilled, how much, the location.
And how to handle it.
Exactly. Basic instructions on containing the spill, or at least who the designated cleanup crew is. Some basic emergency response training for drivers is really essential.
Turns a potential disaster into something manageable.
Hopefully. Preparation is key.
Okay, so the pesticide arrives safely. Where does it go next? Storage. The source seems very specific about a proper storage facility.
Very specific, and for good reason. Ideally, pesticides should be in a separate, dedicated building, not just a corner of the barn.
What makes it proper?
It needs to be enclosed, first off, on a solid, impermeable surface like sealed concrete so spills don't soak in, and protected from rain and sun.
And security.
Absolutely critical. Warning signs, danger pesticides, or similar visible from 25 feet. And securely locked entry points. Keep unauthorized people out. Prevent theft.
Location matters too, right?
Yes. Not somewhere prone to flooding. And at least 100 feet away from any, well, to protect groundwater.
Inside the building.
Needs good ventilation. Maybe insulation or temperature control, because extreme heat or cold can degrade pesticides. Lights should be spark-proof.
Spark-proof. Wow.
Reduces ignition risk with flammable vapors. The floor and shelves need to be impermeable, crack-free, easy to clean. Using secondary containment bins is a great idea.
Like plastic tubs under the containers.
Exactly, to catch leaks and only store pesticides, related equipment, and maybe a spill kit in there. No food, no animal feed, no PPE.
Keep PPE separate to avoid contamination.
Right. And all containers must have clear, readable labels stored so you can see them easily. No mystery chemicals.
That's a fortress, all right. Necessary one. So now we get to the actual mixing. Precision time.
This is where things can go wrong easily if you're not careful. The basics. Read all the labels involved every single time.
Even if you've used it before.
Especially if you think you know it. Formulations change. Get the right PPE identified on the label and make sure you have it and it's in good condition.
And the equipment again.
Check that spray equipment for leaks before you put anything in it. And have that clean water ready, lots of it. Mm. For eye flushing, full body washing if needed.
What about adding the chemicals?
The order you add things to the tank matters. The label often specifies this. Get it wrong, and it might not mix properly or could even clump up.
Now, the guide mentioned something specific for California. Closed mixing and loading systems. What are those?
They're engineering controls designed to basically eliminate or drastically reduce your direct contact with concentrated pesticide.
Why are they required sometimes?
They're mandatory for liquid pesticides with high acute dermal toxicity. The really dangerous stuff if it gets on your skin. Labels that say things like fatal if absorbed through skin or corrosive, causes skin damage.
So it keeps the handler safer.
Much safer. Tier 1 or Tier 2 systems are specified. Another approach is using water-soluble packaging.
Ah, the bags that dissolve.
Right. You just drop the sealed packet into the tank. No need to actually open a container of highly hazardous stuff.
Clever. Okay, beyond those systems, what are the key practical steps for mixing?
Choose your site well. Again, at least 100 feet from unprotected wells. Pick a spot that's easy to clean up if you do spill.
Makes sense.
Measure or weigh carefully in a clear area. If you're outside, stand upwind of any dust or fumes.
And protective gear.
Here's a key takeaway. Always wear a face shield or goggles protective eyewear, plus chemical-resistant gloves when mixing and loading. Even if the label doesn't explicitly require all of that for that specific task.
Better safe than sorry.
Always. Measure and pour below eye level. Prevents splashing up into your face.
Good practical tip.
And pour into a partially filled tank, maybe half to three quarters full. It reduces splashing and foaming.
Okay. Now, what about the empty containers? Especially liquids.
Ah, triple rinsing. This is non-negotiable for most containers. Sidebar 8-3 in the source likely details it.
Walk us through it.
Okay. First, drain the empty container into your spray tank. Let it drip for at least 30 seconds.
Get every last drop.
Then, add rinse water. The amount is specific. About 1/4 of the container volume for containers 5 gallons or less. 1/5 for larger ones.
Okay.
Close it up, shake it, roll it. Get that water to contact all the inside surfaces.
Rinse it thoroughly.
Then drain that rinse water into the tank, again, for at least 30 seconds.
And repeat.
Repeat the fill, shake, drain steps 2 more times. So 3 rinses in total.
Does it really get that much out?
It's incredibly effective. The source probably shows how much active ingredient is removed. It's something like 99% or more after 3 proper rinses.
Wow, that's significant.
It really is. And the final crucial step. Puncture the triple rinsed container, makes it unusable, then store it securely for proper disposal or recycling.
And dry bags, like powders or granules.
Empty them completely, hold them upside down, make sure the seams are straight, shake them out well. Then you'd check with your county ag commissioner on how to dispose of the empty bags.
Got it. Seems like meticulous attention to detail is the name of the game. So mixing's done. Let's talk safe application methods, getting it where it needs to go.
The goal here is precision. Keep the pesticide in the target area. Apply the right amount. Avoid spills, leaks, and especially drift.
Drift is a big one.
Huge. And that means your equipment needs to be calibrated regularly and accurately. If it's not, you're either wasting product and money or worse, risking off-target damage and contamination.
Which brings us neatly to weather. Working with the weather. This seems critical.
It's absolutely critical. Weather can make or break an application, both for effectiveness and safety. Table 8-2 in the source likely lists the hazards.
Let's run through them. Temperature.
High temps, say above 80, 85 Fahrenheit, can cause pesticides to break down faster or volatilize, turn into a gas, increasing drift potential. It can also cause phytotoxicity, damage to the plants.
And too cold.
Below 40 Fahrenheit, some chemicals can become unstable, maybe not mix or spray properly.
What about temperature inversions? It sounds ominous.
They are. That's when you get a layer of warm air trapping cooler air near the ground. Fine spray droplets or vapors can get trapped in that layer and travel long distances. Very unpredictable, very hazardous drift.
Okay. Rain or fog?
Rain, fog, even heavy dew can dilute the pesticide, wash it off the target, cause runoff into water sources, or increase leaching into the soil. And fog can contribute to drift.
Sunny days.
Bright sunlight, UV light, can actually break down some pesticides, reducing their effectiveness.
And wind. This seems like the most obvious one.
It is, but it's tricky. Wind speeds above, say, 10 miles per hour generally mean too much drift and volatilization risk. Stop spraying.
But what about low wind?
Surprisingly, very low wind under 3 miles per hour can also be bad. It can lead to uneven coverage, and it might indicate those stable inversion conditions are present or forming.
Fascinating. So much to track. This connects to site characteristics, right? Knowing the area.
Exactly. You need to identify sensitive areas nearby before you spray.
Like what?
Some are obvious. Ponds, streams, rivers, marshes, wetlands. You need to protect these from runoff and drift.
What about less obvious ones?
Things like fields located over shallow aquifers or near sinkholes or wells. Groundwater is vulnerable. The source mentions checking DPR's groundwater protection area maps online and talking to the local ag commissioner. You want to avoid products known to leach easily in those zones.
Makes sense. What else is sensitive?
Places where people are. homes, schools, hospitals, parks, playgrounds, nearby businesses.
Obvious potential for exposure there.
And neighboring crops. If the pesticide isn't labeled for your neighbor's crop, drift could damage or destroy it. You have to check the label allows application near that crop type.
So, how do you protect these areas?
Using buffer zones is key, leaving an untreated area between your application site and the sensitive area. The width depends on the pesticide, the equipment, and the sensitivity of the site.
It's all about containment and careful targeting. Okay, application's done, but the job isn't finished yet, is it? Cleanup time, starting with the equipment.
Right. Equipment needs to be cleaned and decontaminated after every use.
Why every time?
Prevents residues from contaminating the next batch you mix, which could harm crops or reduce effectiveness. And it protects you, or whoever repairs the equipment, from exposure to leftover chemicals.
How do you clean it?
Wash the outside thoroughly with water and detergent. Flush the inside according to label directions or standard procedures.
Where do you do this cleaning? Can't just let the rinse water run down the drain?
Absolutely not. Cleanup needs to happen either in an area specifically designed to contain runoff, like a concrete pad with a sump, or you can do it back at the actual application site so the rinse water lands where the pesticide was intended to go, assuming the label allows.
Okay. Equipment clean. What about the applicator? Personal cleanup.
The final crucial step for safety. First, clean your PPE according to its instructions. Then, shower thoroughly. Pay special attention to hair and under fingernails residues can hide there.
Change clothes immediately.
Yes. Get into clean, uncontaminated clothing. Put those work clothes straight into a separate plastic bag until they can be washed.
Wash them separately from family laundry.
Always wash pesticide-contaminated clothing separately, and maybe run an empty cycle afterwards to rinse the machine.
And the source mentions basic hygiene during the day.
Super important. Never eat, drink, smoke, chew gum, or use the bathroom before washing your hands and face thoroughly. Break that potential route of exposure.
It really drives home that safety is a continuous process.
It is. It's not one thing, it's everything working together.
Well, this deep dive really highlights that pesticide safety is, it's a whole system, isn't it? From the first thought of using one through planning, transport, storage, mixing, applying, cleaning, it's incredibly layered.
Absolutely. You can see how diligence at every single stage isn't just about following rules. It's about actively protecting yourself, the public, and the environment. It's not just avoiding harm. It's a proactive stance.
A complete system.
Right. And connecting this all together, it makes you realize safety here is this interconnected web, which, you know, it does raise a bigger question.
Go on.
Given how detailed these guidelines are and the clear risks involved if things go wrong, what further responsibilities might individuals or maybe even communities have to ensure that when pesticides are used, it's done as safely as possible? Maybe even thinking beyond the letter of the regulations.
Fostering a culture of safety beyond the rule book. That's a really powerful thought to end on.
Something to consider.
Indeed. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the complex world of pesticide safety. We hope these insights give you a new perspective, maybe even on how comprehensive safety applies elsewhere in life.